through cracks to boil off. Eventually, for all your hard work, you were left holding a perfectly ordinary jewel or amulet or dagger. Fickle, shifting nether was particularly difficult to work with. Ether was more stable, more pure and abstract, in a way, and if you were clever enough, it wasn't impossible to bind the energy of ether-generated light to a stone meant also to generate light. For Dante, however, trying to wield the ether was like trying to wrestle a full-grown tuna to shore using nothing but his elbows. He didn't know why the ether resisted him so strongly. Maybe his inborn talent for handling the nether had come at the cost of being able to work its stabler counterpart. Not everyone who could work nether could work ether, and vice versa. Even among those who could handle both, most found one far easier to work with than the other, and thus specialized in it. In fact, if Dante devoted years to learning the ways of the ether, there was a fair chance he could learn to harness it. But why spend all that time learning to walk with the ether when he could already fly with the nether? A decision he regretted quite bitterly now that he was faced with the loons. As the others had bedded down on the hard dirt, he walked a short way from camp and delved into the loon. Physically, the main body of the earring was a single knuckle-sized talon or tooth, scrimshawed with Norrin runes too fine to read. A short silver chain contains two pea-sized bones, one shaped like a wishbone or stirrup, the other resembling a C or the curve of a jaw. The chain connected the talon to a silver icon resembling an arrowhead. Dante suspected it was a stylized pine tree. On its back, a blunt hook helped secure the arrowhead to a fold of the inner ear while allowing the talon to dangle free. Meanwhile, a clasped ring would connect it securely through Mourne's piercing. Dante closed his hand over the loon and shut his eyes. He breathed slowly, deadening his thoughts, focusing on the feel of moonlight on his skin, the taste of the wind, the noise of the stones. Nether pooled around his hand and sunk through his knuckles. Where it touched the loon, his inner eye saw its shape, threads of ether wound through both silver and bone, the hair fine strands as bright as sunlight on a pane of glass. His mind sight swam closer and closer until each thread loomed as big as a rope. Perhaps it was a rope. At closer look, what appeared to be a single thread was composed of hundreds of other minute fibers. He moved closer yet, examining a fiber, and saw it too was woven from hundreds of threads of its own. He pulled back, dizzy. The bright white threads faded. The loon was a simple thing again, a physical trinket of metal and bone. It felt like short minutes had passed. In the gaps in the canopy, the stars had leapt a quarter of the way across the sky. He closed his eyes and delved again. Did the structure of these threads within threads lend the item its power? Or did that just happen to be the form that power took when the ether that formed them bound to the matter? This time, he kept his focus broad. The gleaming white threads converged at three distinct points. One node met inside the tiny wishbone. The other met inside the tiny C. The other was less densely packed around the blunt hook on the back side of the arrowhead, more resembling a tight net than a solid ball of ether. Other threads tangled through the earring as well, sparse by contrast. Structural support, perhaps. Subjectively, he spent an hour or so poking at the loon with delicate probes of nether, exploring crannies, turning it over for a better feel for its whole. And when he emerged, the dawn approached the eastern shore. He rose to urinate, then rooted through his pack for his water skin and a tore-off handful of bread. Long stale. At least the humidity kept it moist. Then he fitted the loon to his ear, holding it in place, he had no piercing himself, and listened. A minute later, he'd heard nothing but the pine jays greeting the sun. He waited for Mourn to wake up, empty his bladder and gargle a mixture of water and salt, then held up the loon. "You both hear and speak through this." Mourn tipped his head to one side. "I used to." "Was it always active, or did it only speak to you when someone had something to say?"
"It spoke like an old monk. Rarely, and only when telling me what to do."
Dante smiled. The others woke soon, stretching, rubbing their limbs. Blaze spit the dryness from his mouth. Lyra stretched and executed a choreographed set of martial exercises. After a cold breakfast, they cut through the woods toward the town on the river. Dante's head felt like a bruised cloud. They paused at the edge of the woods. Grey light touched the wet timbers of the town. A few pedestrians mingled with the mule teams hauling sacks and wagons to and from the piers. Smoke rose from the chimneys of pine-board houses.
"Look like anyone's planning to kill us,"
Blaze said. Dante squinted.
"No more than usual."
Lyra frowned between them.
"That's usual."
"We have an unfair share of detractors." Blaze hoisted his sword belt up his hips.
"Probably because I'm so pretty."
Two barges creaked at the piers. A rowboat inched downstream. Seagulls soared over the grey waves. Dante's pockets felt very light. He needn't have worried. Down on the docks, where the water smelled like wet rocks and fish bones, Blaze haggled with a barge master. The captain expected a load of coal and timber that morning. He'd be taking it all the way to Yalan. Short-handed, he offered the four of them passage in exchange for helping to load the barge and guard it from pirates on their way to the sea. Dante teetered on the planks of the dock, gazing forlornly at the broad barge.
"I could use a nap."
"That's what nights are for," Blaze said. "If you plan it right, you can even get two or three good naps in a row."
"I was working on Mourn's jewelry."
"Is that all it takes to make you swoon?
If Lyra gave you a pair of her bloomers, you'd die of starvation."
Lyra gazed pointedly toward the river. A pink blotch appeared on her turned cheek. Dante left for the nearest inn, a two-story place with a flagstone-paved porch and a mast rising from its roof, a towering trunk of pine stripped of all branches and bark. The wood was lacquered smooth, shiny under the overcast skies. The innkeeper was in the process of blessing plates of eggs and potatoes and bread, flicking drips of water over the steaming bowls, then snapping sprigs of wintrel and depositing them in the small wire basket suspended over the hexagon candles at the center of the table. Toasted mint filled the warm room. The innkeeper said a quick prayer to Aron, then finished the rite by blowing a pinch of flour mingled with black sand, the grist of Aron's broken mill, over the candles. Dante watched, transfixed. However many times he saw such open worship of Aron, he couldn't help his shock. Back in Malin, it would get a man tortured at the least. Probably he'd never be seen again. Dante rented a room for the day and collapsed into the straw mattress. Lyra knocked an hour later. He rose, confused and aching, feeling worse than before. Down at the docks, mules and wagons crowded onto ramps, unloading cords of wood and crates of coal. A crewman with a salt-and-pepper beard gave Lyra a wink.
"Now need to dirty your hands, ma'am. Prefer a tour of the ship instead."
She stared him down. "Do you think my breasts get in the way if I try to lift a crate?" The man backed off with his palms raised, muttering an apology. Behind Lyra's back, Blaze shot Dante a smirk. It was the last smile Dante would see for some time. The next 2 hours were a monotony of picking up a cord of wood, crossing the flat gangplank, and tromping downstairs to one of the holds. Dante's leather gloves and the front of his doublet grew crusty with resinous sap. Blaze was panting within a few minutes, too. Lyra shuffled back and forth and up and down, face grey with pain, pausing regularly to catch her breath and rest her leg. Morn came and went without slowing down, strong as a flood, inevitable as the tides. Before long, Dante lost track of everything but the lessened gravity of setting down a bundle of wood. 2 hours later, he rose to the docks and blinked in confusion. They were empty, removed of everything but stray twigs, flakes of bark, and black patches of coal dust. They were done. So was he. Ensconced in a hammock below decks, he slept until darkness. On waking, his body was sore from neck to soles, but his mind felt as if he'd just emerged from a warm bath. For several minutes, he did nothing more than breathe the cold air, smell the clean water, and listen to the soft slap of waves against the hull. Then he retired to a quiet corner of the empty deck and considered the loon until dawn. Examining its physical and ethereal structures wasn't doing him any good. He didn't know enough about artificing to tease any meaning from the knotted and netted lines of ether. Instead, he needed to approach the loon from a theoretical standpoint. If he understood the thinking that allowed it to be created in the first place, he could, if nothing else, present Callie with a framework to allow the old man to duplicate the earring's function. Not that this was any easier. What did the loon do? It sent your voice, and allowed you to hear back from someone who might be hundreds of miles away. Earlier, Morn had informed him the effect was instantaneous, or something very near it. So its principles didn't rely on those of noises that carried long distances. Thunder, for instance, could be heard miles from its source, but it could take several seconds after the lightning for the roar to reach your ears. If a trumpeter sounded his horn across a valley, you wouldn't hear the first note until after he finished blowing. Sounds traveled fast, but it wasn't instant. That implied the distance itself was somehow shortened, as if a piece of the speaker and the listener had been embedded in the loon, so when the speaker spoke, the loon spoke with him, however far away he might be. Morn dashed that theory, too. According to him, a loon could be used by anyone. That was part of why the Clan of the Nine Pines kept their secret so close. Any enemy could listen in as easily as a member of the clan. Alternately, the loons themselves were perfect duplicates, identical twins who resonated as one. But Dante'd never heard of such a thing. You couldn't just copy a tooth. Silver, cast in the same mold from the same ingot, did not make the pieces the same. He couldn't rule out the idea completely, but as a solution, it didn't compel him in the slightest. 4 days cycled along. Blaze gambled with the crew by nights, winning more than he lost. It wouldn't be enough to buy them passage on a ship to Narashtovik, but at least they'd be able to pay for food and lodging while they worked out those logistics. Lyra fended off the advances of sailors, and paced around the deck to keep her leg limber and strong. Morn whittled arrowheads from scrap wood, embellishing his pieces with hooks and grooves and jagged edges. "Is that supposed to kill someone?" Blaze said, leaning over a piece shaped like a devil's saw blade. "Or circumcise him?" Morn frowned up from his makeshift workbench.
"What circumcise?"
Blaze grinned. Dante walked off before he could explain. After the turmoil of the last few weeks, the peace of their passage downriver was like an evening beer after a day behind the plow. Occasionally they were called on to haul cargo to the piers of various villages and towns, but for the most part, those 4 days passed in total quiet. The morning of the fifth day since they hopped ship, the river widened until a mile of water separated its shores. Craggy islands jutted from the slowing current, furry with pines. The western shore neared as the river swung due north. Smoke curled from the damp trees. Sections of forest disappeared in favor of dark brown fields and young green shoots of winter wheat. Above an inlet protected by a high spar of limestone, docks jutted into the gray water. Downstream, three more barges coasted toward the sea. A two-deck galley thrashed the water with its many oars. They reached Yalan by mid-afternoon. The city consumed the western bank of the delta. Two high-arched bridges spanned the sluggish water, connecting the larger islands and the eastern shore with its smoky tents, shacks, and furnaces. Masts piked the river, clustering thickly on piers that bustled with sailors and merchants and travelers. Instead of a wall, the city was banded at intervals by greasy canals some 40 feet wide and spanned by low wooden bridges. Flat-bottomed boats navigated the canals with poles or ropes strung along the brick-lined walls. Inland, three hills considered the sprawl, their crowns heavy with towers and high wooden manors. Beneath, three-story row houses stood shoulder to shoulder, capped by sharply canted roofs of tar-sealed pine. The shining gray sea waited beyond the last of the islands. Dante smelled salt and shit and the cold of northern waters. "What do you think?" he said to Blaze, who watched beside him. "It looks," Blaze said, "like a place where things happen." "I think it looks like a place where you figure out how to get us a boat." "Why do I always have to be the one who gets things done?" "I'm sorry," Dante said, twirling the loon between his fingers. "I've been a little busy trying to save us all from decorating the spires of Setevan with our skulls." Blaze snorted. "You've got nothing to worry about. Your skull's too ugly to show in public." "Seriously, do you have any ideas?" "I have a very firm thought, in fact." Dante raised his brows. "What's that?" "That you should shut up and let me do my thing." The barge angled toward the crowded docks. A couple hundred yards from the crush of ships, an oared tug pilot met them in the waves. Ropes flew between the vessels. Ashore, a team of oxen churned their hooves in the mud, guiding the barge into port. Hulking Norren and well-tanned men coiled ropes, lowered barrels, and argued on the briny planks. Dante pulled up the cowl of his plain black cloak. The barge squeaked against the dock. Sailors flung ropes over the railing, followed by their own bodies. They landed lightly and tied knots as nimbly as the toe dancers of sway. Across the deck, Lyra climbed into the sunlight. Dante moved to intercept her. There's a fountain at the far end of the plaza. He pointed, then pulled her behind to the safety of a cabin wall. "The one shaped like a leaping salmon. I want you and Morn to wait there while Blaze and I see about finding us a boat." The creases of a subtle insult crinkled her eyes. "Do you consider us baggage?"
"Baggage?"
"Bulky objects to be set aside whenever you plan to put your hands to use." He frowned.
"I consider you flags. Conspicuous things to be waving around when I'm worried about being found and flayed by the agents of a wealthy lord."
She regarded him for some time.
"You won't learn to wholly trust us until you put us to use."
"We'll see about that as soon as we're out of increasingly hostile territory. For now, trust me and go wait by that damn fountain." Sailors and stevedores hollered back and forth. Once more, the four of them pitched in to help unload, sweating in the chill breeze. The last of the lumber touched the dock an hour before the sun would touch the western hills. Packs shouldered, Dante and Blaze thumped down the planks to the relatively dry land beyond the docks, a sodden square of wide-spaced cobbles choked with mud, sand, manure, and well-trampled grass. taverns, public houses, and tailors fronted the square. Blocky warehouses rose behind them. Morn and Lyra entered the crowds and crossed toward the fountain with the salmon. Beneath his hood, Dante scanned the throng, easily distinguishing the sailors in their tight leggings from the locals in their knee-length fur coats. No one seemed to be paying any special mind to the Norren and the woman. By the time Dante turned away, Blaze had already flagged down his first sailor and asked which ships were Narashtovic bound. The sailor chewed his beard a moment, and then, his breath smelling of yeasty beer, rattled off the names of three vessels that would depart the next day.
"Where are they docked?"
Blaze said. The sailor scowled.
"Seems to me anybody who knows that would be some kind of expert. You know the thing about experts?"
"They have expertise."
"And they don't give it away free."
Blaze's brows muddled. Then he laughed.
"They sure don't. For your time and trouble, most honored bosun."
He passed the bearded man an iron twopenny. The sailor ran his thumb along its clipped rim.
"The boons at Pier 15, the Vanea's song at Fairy's Punt. Can't miss it," he said, pointing downstream to a dock that bent from the shore like a misshapen Y. "And the bad tidings is berthed at the Westlong docks."
He gestured further downriver, then squinted between Dante and Blaze.
"Might not want to hop ship just yet, though. Hear bad things are coming Narashtovic way."
"Like what?"
Dante said.
The man shrugged, gazing off to sea with weighty significance. "Aron's own dead. Sent to right the heresy of that old man in the tower."
He shrugged again.
"Anyway, that's what they say."
"Zombies?"
Blaze said, hushed.
"My goodness,
I'm going to need a bigger sword."
Pier 15 was just a short ways down the muddy banks. The boon was a large longboat, bearing a single square-sailed mast and a high bank of oar holes, but one of its mates informed them it was all booked and refused access to either of the ship's quartermasters. Marine-green kelp swirled in the cold estuary. They thumped down the salt-whitened planks toward the bent protrusion of Fairy's Punt. There, sailors dangled on ropes over the railings of the Vanea's song, gouging barnacles from its high hull with flat iron chisels.
"Taking passengers!"
Blaze hollered from below. Without turning, a soldier jerked his thumb at a rope bridge bobbing softly in the low swells. Dante frowned, waiting for more explicit permission. Blaze strode forward and threw himself onto the ladder. From the ship's deck, Dante had a clear view of the longboats, galleys, barges, caravels, and sloops snarling the dock between them and the open sea. Inland, a seaborne breeze dragged chimney smoke across the steep roofs of the city. Blaze rapidly learned two of the song's quartermasters were ashore, in taverns unknown, but the third remained in his cabin. Blaze knocked on his well-cleaned door without hesitation. A middle-aged man opened it a moment later, his scowl deepening the heavy creases around his eyes, one of which was clamped tight around a thick glass lens.
"We'd like passage to Narashtovic," Blaze said. "We have..."
The man's lens flashed.
"Four rounds and four pennies per body."
"Well, you see, we don't have that, but we do have someone in Narashtovic who would happily..."
"Four rounds and four pennies per body to be paid before your boots hit the deck."
Dante bared his teeth. It was easily three times what they had on hand.
"Perhaps we could strike a bargain for other services."
The man's vowels were flat with an eastern accent Dante couldn't quite place.
"Four rounds and four pennies per body."
Blazer's spine stiffened.
"You, sir, have just lost a customer. Four of them."
He turned before the quartermaster could interject another word. They descended to the dock, which was suddenly chilly and thick with the scent of overripe fish.
"They don't leave until tomorrow," Dante said.
That gives us plenty of time to locate a few pockets heavier than our own to relieve their owners of their burden. Blaze nodded, distant.
I don't know. That could attract attention.
Since when did you consider that a bad thing?
Since legions of soldiers might be on our heels, not to mention the grumbling we'd face from Lyra.
Dante waved his hand. She's so high on her horse, I doubt we'd hear a word of it.
Anyway, just because crimes are fun and easy doesn't mean I always want to do them.
Blaze gestured downstream, in the vague direction the sailor had indicated for the Westlong docks. Besides, we've got at least one legit chance left. Dante considered him a moment, then headed down the docks, swerving around an inborn oxen team and the spittle flying from the driver's lips. A quarter-mile walk took them to a rather less peopled stretch of warehouses and half-paved streets. Grains of wheat and corn speckled the muddy alleys. Planks lay between the stone streets and the doors of the blocky lofts and silos. Broad, flat barges wallowed in the waters beside the thick piers. Mussels and dark green slime coated the pilings. The Bad Tidings was one of the few sailboats at the Westlong, with one high mainmast and two smaller and well-mended sails snapping in the steady offshore wind. Blaze hollered more than once before a sailor in a knit cap popped up on its deck. The crewman let them aboard to see yet another quartermaster, a man in his early 40s with a beard thick enough to raise robins in. His name was Mart, and he was blunt but reasonable. Over the course of a few minutes, Dante and Blaze bargained him from a fare that outstripped the official on the song, and down to a mere 3 rounds and change apiece, still more than double what they had on hand.
I'm sorry, but that's as low as reason allows.
Mart reached for a much-scribbled scrap of paper.
If you change your minds, we'll be here until tomorrow afternoon.
Dante sighed through his nose.
I hope by then to be able to take advantage of your generosity.
Blaze glanced out the porthole. Sunset's last red spark trickled through the bubbly glass. He leaned from his chair and slapped the wooden floor.
What are you hauling here?
Mart glanced up, eyes sharp.
Barley. A whole lot of barley.
Got rats?
Does the king's mistress have crabs?
That would explain the pettiness of some of his recent policies.
Maybe we can offer you something besides money. Blaze tipped his head toward Dante.
My friend here is the finest rat-catcher in the land, possibly in all the lands.
Mart smiled indulgently.
Is that so?
So they say. Dante played along.
Here's my proposal.
Blaze leaned forward conspiratorially, patting Dante on the shoulder.
My friend Blegworth goes down into your hold and goes to work on your rats. If he clears them all out, we get free passage, us and our two companions. But if he leaves a single rat alive, we go on our merry way, and you still have a whole lot less rats in your hold.
I'll need complete solitude, Dante said. The presence of others might scare the rats into their dens.
Mart juttered his lower jaw. So you can steal the rum, or set fire to the entire hold. What then?
Blaze held out his hands.
Then you and your crew stab us until you feel justice is served.
The quartermaster laughed for the first time.
I can't tell if you're arrogant or insane. But it sounds like I win either way. If you can get rid of all the rats, the trip is on me.
They squared off the details. The crew was still in the midst of relocating goods, refreshing supplies, and patching sails, but Mart claimed he'd have them cleared out below decks by 11th bell of the evening. Dante climbed down to the deck and headed off ship. On their way to meet Morn and Lyra, Blaze stepped over a grassy pile of manure.
So, can you actually do that?
I have no idea.
Fantastic. Do you think you can do it?
Dante slowly shook his head.
I have an idea. I can't say whether it's a good one. If it were, I would be highly skeptical it was yours.
Thanks for volunteering me, by the way. If I can't pull it off, I expect you to sell your body for the cause.
Blaze snorted. If I did that, we could buy our own boat.
Then get to work.
Dante detoured around the ring of hooting bystanders. In their middle, two men swayed and postured, throwing more insults than punches.
What did you call me back there?
Blegworth?
You look like a Blegworth.
Lanterns sputtered from plaza poles and the cabins of boats. Blaze waited at the plaza's edge while Dante rendezvoused with the others. Water sprayed from the mouth of the stone salmon on the fountain.
They accepted his explanation with little comment. Mourn looked tired, Lyra stiff.
For whatever help it would be with their lodgings, Dante passed over his comically light purse.
"Meet back here at dawn," he said. "I'll be the one who smells like rats."
Lyra tilted her head.
"What exactly are you doing out there?"
"What I do best. Exterminating."
They parted ways. With several hours to kill, Dante and Blaze meandered the nearby streets, eventually settling in at a thriving tavern. Rather than tables, deep shelves stood at rib height along all four walls. A vaulted ceiling with naked beams allowed space for a sort of shack in the center of the room, where men lined up to step through a curtain, spilling a fan of bright green light across the tavern floor. They emerged a minute later with mugs in hand. At intervals, smoke jetted from the pipes protruding near the top of the shack, smelling of kelp and orange rind and bitter lerret root. Blaze pressed iron into Dante's hand.
"Go buy some drinks, will you?"
Dante frowned at the hissing shack.
"Why me?"
"Because I'm paying."
"And because I'm bigger and I'll shove you around if you don't."
Dante joined the roped-off line. It moved quickly. Each time a man came and went through the curtain to the shack, green light washed the floor. Soon it was his turn. Inside the shack, green light gleamed from bottles of all colors of the sea. Blue, gray, green, and black. A very average-looking man tapped his fingers behind a short bar. Dante stared at the source of the light, an unwinking stone suspended a few inches from the ceiling.
"Is that a torch stone?"
The man didn't glance up.
"That doesn't sound like any drink I've ever heard."
Since they were within spitting distance of the Hukali Islands, Dante bought two anise-flavored Caven and found Blaze parked at one of the drinking shelves. Past the gritty glass windows, the bustle of daily labor shifted to the whoop of nocturnal play.
"What do you think?" Blaze asked, once they'd drained their second mugs. They'd been talking around the war for the last few minutes. "I mean, what do you really think?"
"What do you think?"
"I think everyone's full of shit. Hot, windy shit."
"Wait, that's pretty gross."
Blaze tipped back his mug, dislodging another couple drops of rosy liquor.
"I think Setevan gins up an ultimatum, the clans huff and puff for a couple weeks before backing down and accepting their demands, and Callie plays it as dumb as he can to continue the illusion we're keeping our noses clean. Nobody wants a war."
Dante gazed out the greasy window. Low clouds had encroached with the night, and misty drizzle dewed the cobbles.
"I think Setevan's growing increasingly displeased with the unruliness of the eastern branches of their kingdom. I don't think they'll discard the opportunity to put us in our place."
Hours plodded by in that bovine way time takes while waiting on an unwanted task. Dante sipped his way through his third cup. 10th bell rang from the spires of Tame.
A half hour later, he cut Blaze off and started back for the bad tidings. The ship was so quiet, you could hear every wave rippling against its hull. Thousands of pounds of sealed wood creaked and popped. Up top, Mart waited for them, flanked by four sailors armed with straight swords.
"The hold is all yours,"
he gestured to his men. "If you try anything funny, you're all theirs."
"Just them?"
Blaze said.
"And I'll require your swords."
"Ah." Blaze reached for his buckles. "Well, that might even it out." Dante passed over his sword and his two larger knives. Mart nodded to a crewman as tall and thin as the mainmast, who moved to pat Dante down. Dante clung to his last blade, a pick as short and slender as his little finger.
"I'll need this one."
Mart chuckled, expression unchanging.
"That's how you'll be rid of them. We leave tomorrow. Of this year.
See you at dawn." Dante smiled with half his mouth. He nodded at Blaze. "Cover the top of the stairs. No humans are to come down, nor rats to come up."
Blaze crossed his thumbs in the salute of the Bressel Armsmen's Guild he'd never actually been fit enough to join.
"Of course, my liege."
Dante stepped over the rim of the hatch and clumped down the stairs. The main chamber of the lower deck was a square roughly 30 feet to a side, lit by a single smokeless catch lamp at both ends. Barrels lined most walls, blocked and chinked in place. It smelled of fresh beer and stale water and the acrid stink of small mammals. Barley gritted underfoot. Something small rustled from the gloom. Large serving tables took up the remainder of the room. Small cabins filled the aft with a galley and chain locker at the fore, the iron links of the anchor lying heavy on the floor. The second set of stairs descended to the main hold. This was split between three main spaces, front, middle, and rear. It was pitch black. Dante drew out his torch stone and breathed on it until white light expanded over the casks, barrels, sacks, crates, and chests. Some sections were packed higher than his head, held fast through arcane packing techniques that required few, if any, ropes or restraints. White grain dappled the deck. So, too, did tiny black droppings. He would work his way down. The creatures of the dark always descended in times of crisis. He ascended to the lower deck and knelt beside the stairs. He drew the slender knife and traced a line of blood across his left forearm. He'd never summoned the Nether on open water before, but if it differed from the sources on land, it was too subtle for his eyes. The same moth-like shadows fluttered from the cracks and corners, coating his hands, turning gently as they waited to be shaped. He rubbed his thumb against the torch stone until it faded, leaving him in the weak light of the catch lamps. It didn't take long. Submerged in the Nether, his sense of time was somewhat blurred, destabilized perhaps by the eternal cycles of the shadows. But no more than 5 minutes could have passed before the first rat crept from the maze of cargo. It moved in stops and starts, stopping to haunch back, nose and whiskers twitching, before it lurched forward to snatch up a stray kernel of barley and crunch it down to nothing. Dante stilled his mind and struck the rat with a narrow spear of nether. It flopped to its side, legs kicking, smearing blood across the timbers. All creatures, great and small, carried a pulse of nether within their skin or shells. By the cycle of Aron, all life itself was netherborn, brought to motion by the black grist ground from Aron's cracked mill. With his fear and rage and pain, man carried the most nether of all, but if Dante made himself go quiet enough, he could feel the thin thread waning in the struck rat's veins. Even once each of its organs went still and dark,
The Nether didn't disappear. It simply quieted, too. Dormant. Only when the body decayed and dissolved would the shadows also pass away into the earth. Dante seized this snoothing Nether, melding it with a strand of his own. With the thought, he returned the rat to its feet, where it waited in perfect, undead stillness. "Go," he told it. "Find the others. Bring them to me." It skittered into darkness. A moment later, a short, inhuman shriek pierced the silence. Fur whispered on wood. The undead rat backed into the cleared space around the steps, tugging a fresh corpse along in its teeth. Dante brought this one back to its feet, too. Before he ordered it away, he closed his eyes and shifted his sight into it. Vertigo bent his head. He looked back on himself, terribly tall even when kneeling, a pale-faced giant whose features were sharpened with the cruelty of one whose role is to kill. He sent the rat his command. His second vision swung as it turned on its claws and raced into the towering alleys of crates. Its whiskers tickled along the splintery wood. It reached the wall of a cabin and squeezed into a crack that would be invisible to a standing human. Dante felt it rustling among loose shreds of chaff, splinters, and the browning rinds of lemons. In total darkness, its teeth clamped down on something hairless and pink. The baby vermin screamed. Dante opened his eyes and gazed at nothing. It was dawn by the time he returned to deck. Mart raised thick and skeptical brows, then lowered his gaze to Dante's left arm, laced with paper-fine cuts, and crusted with rusty layers of blood. The man's face softened into something that might have been concern.
"Sleepin' or on," Mart said. "Did you challenge them all to a fist fight?"
Blaze shouldered past the quartermaster, puffy-eyed, with the grueling sort of hangover that comes from burning off one's liquor without the help of sleep.
"Well?"
"Well what?" Dante said.
"Did you get all the rats?"
"Oh, that? I ferreted out the last one hours ago." Blaze gaped.
"Then what have you been doing down there all that time? Napping? I want to nap."
Dante let out a breath.
"I understand the loons."
Chapter 7. Fortunately, Mart brushed that off as the delirious statement of a man who spent hours in the dark with no company but his thoughts and a growing heap of dead rats. As hand-counted by a teen boy who was clearly on the outs with Mart, these totaled 240 all told, a bleeding and mutilated heap that had the growing crowd of sailors eyeing Dante with some emotion between respect and disgust. Mart took a tour below decks, while Dante leaned against the railing and let the ocean wind wash the scent of blood, fur, and feces from his nose. Mart thumped up the steps a few minutes later. He leaned against the rails beside Dante and gazed seaward.
"The fact of the matter is, there's no proof of your achievement."
Dante turned, incredulous, and gestured at the mountain of motionless rodents.
"What do you call that? Coincidence? Did I smuggle them on board in my pockets?"
Contempt hardened Mart's eyes, quickly fading.
"Our agreement insisted you kill every single rat."
It took a moment for this to penetrate the fog of sleeplessness around Dante's mind. He stiffened.
"And there's no way to prove they're all dead?" "Not without tearing the ship apart, board by board."
"I see." He supposed he should be angry. He supposed he would be, after he'd had some sleep. After the bad tidings had sailed away.
"But if I left you ashore, my crew would tear me apart, board by board."
Mart nodded to the idling men.
One scooped up a rat and waggled it in a bearded man's face, earning himself a meaty punch in the shoulder. The rat bounced from the deck. Men laughed.
You've earned your passage.
You could have told me that from the start.
I could have, but I didn't.
He gave Dante a long look. Regardless, if we arrive in Narashtovik and discover you've missed any, I can simply pass your debt along to Callimandicus. That wiped the fog from Dante's brain.
If you want a safe trip, I wouldn't speak a word of who we are.
I'm not going to give your name away. I'm responsible for all my ship's cargo, human or otherwise. Now fetch your friends. He did just that. At the Fountain of the Salmon, Lyra and Morn looked enviably well-rested. Back on board, they were shown two cabins below decks, one for three males, one for the lady. Lyra's jaw drew tight.
I am sworn to protect this man. She inclined her head at Dante. I can't do that isolated in my room.
The young sailor ducked his eyes.
Ma'am, barring storms or giant squid, I think he'll be perfectly safe. After seeing what he's done to those rats, nobody's going to want to find out what he'd do to a human.
That only raised further questions from Lyra, but at least it settled the arrangement of sleeping quarters. Dante meant to see the ship's departure into open ocean. He'd sailed enough rivers, but never the sea. But on settling into his down mattress to rest his body, the rest of them quickly followed suit. By the time he woke in the early afternoon, the shore was a far line of pine green across miles and miles of white-capped grey. According to a crewman whose superhuman focus on reining in his flapping sail may have been due to the fact he'd lost two fingers earlier in life, the trip to Narashtovik would take 6 days, allowing for the wind and their planned stop in port at Canova. All told, they'd span a good 400 knots, which struck Dante as a miracle. Even with good roads and spare horses, travelling overland would have taken them more than twice as long and been far more dangerous. In fact, the duration was perfect. 6 days ought to be plenty of time to confirm his operational theory of Morn's loon. If Dante was equal parts lucky and dedicated, he might even have a fresh one to show Callie. If anything could blunt the old man's wrath, it would be an item of immense practicality that came wrapped in the priceless ribbons of secret lore. Lyra happily lent him the privacy of her cabin. She sat outside on a stool while Dante set to work. The boy who'd shown them their cabins turned out to own a 2-book library consisting of The Cycle of Aron and a picaresque novel about pirates who spent more time clinging to the wreckage of their ship than in committing any actual piracy. He lent Lyra the book without a second thought, and even through the closed door, Dante could occasionally hear the rasp of pages or Lyra's warm, low chuckle. Besides that, however, his only distractions came from the pitch of the ship, which his stomach hadn't begun to adapt to, the occasional holler from the crew up above, and rarest of all, the carrying cry of the huge winged birds that scoured the ocean surface for prey. In truth, the rodent body count had been 246. Dante had slipped 6 of the smaller adults into his pocket before rising from the slaughter to show Mart his catch. Because he had a theory. If his theory proved seaworthy, he expected he'd need more than one body to refine it before landfall. The idea had arrived from a special kind of nowhere, a place no other human had been, from inside the dead rat's own heads. Yet the concept was simple enough Dante could have put it together years ago. When he was linked to the body of a rat, he could sense whatever they sensed, see what they saw, hear what they heard. Assumedly, he could taste what they tasted. This worked whether they were in the palm of his hand or miles away. Essentially, they were doing the exact same thing the loons did. He borrowed, requisitioned, and gathered more than just the dead rats. In addition to these,
which lay in neat piles atop a cloth on the cabin's floor. He had a hand axe, his small knife, a tin spoon, the strips of what had once been one of his older shirts, and perhaps most important of all, a bucket of water. He separated one of the rats from the others, took up the hand axe, and severed its head less than expertly. With a concentrated effort to ignore the noises and smells his next actions made, he used the knife to peel away all the skin, flesh, and tendons from the skull, then picked the axe back up and whacked it once along its long axis. A splinter of bone pattered across the pinewood floor. He noticed the smell then, the thickening blood and hours-old flesh, and opened the small round porthole. After a few breaths at the window, he raised the axe again. The next strike split the skull from snout to base. Pink mush splattered the deck. The bone hadn't broken completely along its bottom edge. Dante cracked it in half, then used the spoon and knife to dig out everything he could reasonably extract. Uncertain the leftovers would be of any use, he set these aside in one of the cloths, then spent a long time cleaning his hands and the two pieces of mostly empty skull. He knelt beside the mess and brought forth a palmful of nether, which he sunk into the bones like a wave into sand. He re-established the ethereal link between the two halves, then opened another line between himself and the half he dubbed the ear. He set the ear to his own ear, aligned the ear hole of the second piece, which he thought of as the mouth, to his mouth, and said, "Hello." Had he heard? He put the ear to his other ear and tried again. As previously, the word sounded strange, somehow distorted, but not conclusively different from whatever he was hearing aloud. Perhaps it was simply too close for his senses to separate the sounds. He cracked the door. Lyra looked up, closing her book around her finger. Dante flushed with sudden embarrassment. "Lyra," he held out the mouth, "I need you to do something for me. I'm going to go back into your room. 3 seconds after I close the door, say something into that." She reached out for the cracked bone, then jerked her hand away. "Is that a rat skull?" "Of course not. It's one half of a rat skull." "What am I doing with one half of a rat skull?" "Helping me win a war." She considered him for a long moment. "Are you being serious?" He held up his palms, discovered the underside of one forearm was globby with gore, and hurriedly wiped it off on the leg of his pants, which he immediately regretted. "I'm sure this looks very strange." "It looks like you've decided to become a butcher, or a pervert, or some combination of the two." "You don't have to touch it." He bent and placed it on the floor. "Just speak into it. Directly. Where the ear would be, ideally. Oh, and don't speak loudly enough for me to hear what you're saying through the door. Understand?" "As much as that's possible." He closed himself inside the cabin and held up the ear. 3 seconds later, he heard Lyra murmur, "If you're hearing this, then perhaps you're not crazy." But rather than hearing the words through his ear, the way Morn had described the loon as functioning, he heard them inside his head, the same way he'd perceived such things when he was piloting the dead rat around the hold to hunt down the living. He returned to the hall. "I spoke into it," Lyra said, with the unconcealed disgust of a childless adult watching another person's kids paw through an apple cart. "I'm not crazy." She blinked at him. "Perhaps not." He took the mouth and went back inside her room to kneel beside the mattress and think. So, it was possible to take pieces of a skull, link them together, and share the senses experienced by one of those parts by the other pieces of the whole. In a sense, then, he had just created a very poor loon. It was one way, only he could use it, and it would cease to function the moment he dropped his focus from the link between ear and mouth. Still, it felt like he was onto the principle. Now all he had to do was refine it. He understood how to solve the one-way problem at once. If he could be either a mouth or an ear, either able to speak or hear, all it would take to be able to do both would be to combine two sets of these things. To create a linked mouth A and ear A, a second mouth B and ear B. Then combine mouth A and ear B into one loon, and mouth B and ear A into another, such that words spoken into one loon would be heard through the other, and vice versa. He did just that, axing his halved skull into quarters, so each fraction contained a part of the original structure of the skull's ear port. Then he formed two proto-loons, and had Lyra speak into each in turn while he listened from the cabin. He could hear her through both pieces. She couldn't hear him, of course, because she lacked any link to the loons herself, but if he could solve that problem, all that would remain was to make the items permanent. Day faded from the porthole. He opened the window and flung the rat's headless body and bits of brain into the sea. He hid the intact corpses as well as his skull pieces in his pouch, wishing for some ice or a cool hole in the ground. They were already starting to get a bit squishy. He cleaned his tools and his hands in the reddish water and then sloshed that out the window as well, splattering just a bit on the interior wall. Feeling work-worn but energized, he went to the second cabin to find Morn, whom he engaged in a makeshift game of Nulladoon, using pieces cobbled from stray barley, pennies, and bits of cork, with clay tea plates standing in as terrain. They set up on one of the common tables below decks. Before the end of their second turn, a pair of off-duty sailors stood over their shoulders, brows knit, asking questions about the intricacies of play. Soon, most of the free crew stood about them, placing bets over mugs of watered rum. Dante lost, drawing sighs and curses from those who'd wagered on him, and cheers from the opposition, but he grinned anyway. He'd already determined the shape of the puzzle of the loon. Now it was just a matter of filling in the pieces. They made port in the Hukali Islands 2 days later. Dante scowled at the jagged crags and churning windmills. He was no closer to any solutions. Whenever he tried to load up his loons with enough nether to keep them functional after he dropped his focus, the bones leaked his shadows like a punctured water skin. He'd done no better with the problem of getting the loons to make audible noise, rather than restricting their transmission to the brain case of their creator. In fact, on dwelling on that problem, he'd only discovered another. That unless he wanted the loons to yammer aloud to everyone in earshot, he needed to find a way to make them whisper to their intended recipient alone. It was a reminder, and not a welcome one, that for all the ways he'd learned to command the nether, to forge killing spears, to make the dead walk, to bend reality to illusion, he lacked the scantest understanding of many of its subtleties. For him, trying to make anything permanent was like pouring water on a flat floor and expecting it to take the shape of an angel. "You look," Blaze said beside him on the windy deck, "like someone's been squeezing your nuts all night."
"That would be bad."
"Maliciously." Sailors called back and forth, trimming the bad tidings to angle it toward the island of cliffs and cold marshes where roundhouses hunkered in the wind.
"It's the loons," Dante said. "I know the effects I need. I have no idea how to create them."
"Well, that's a bit of luck, then."
"Yes, about as lucky as a starving man with a net and no ocean."
"No, I mean that we're here, in Kyoto."
Blaze gestured to the modest city of stone homes and wood huts buffeted with shedwind stalks, tall reeds which held uncannily still in all but the harshest gales.
"The Hanassans have their temple here.
on Mount Serini. You know, I don't get why mountains are so popular among the monks. It's like such a feat of piety to walk up a hill. Anyway, the Hanassans know everything.
Dante cocked his head.